Welcome to the ADHD Mums Podcast, a safe place for everyday Australian mums to discuss their struggles with ADHD, motherhood and life. Hello and welcome to the next episode of ADHD Mums. Today we have an episode on positive behaviour support. Renee is a psychologist with a passion for improving the quality of life of neurodivergent individuals. Renee has had a family member that was neurodivergent, and I think that sparked for her the real need to give back and have more understanding. Is that right, Renee?
Absolutely.
Perfect. And so Renee has spent the last 25 years working with neurodivergent infants, children, adolescents, and adults to deliver respectful and compassionate neuroaffirming approaches to assist individuals to reach their goals and thrive. Renee has extensive experience working as a senior and principal practitioner within the public, not-for-profit and private sectors, providing specialist behaviour support for neurodivergent individuals that present with complex behaviours that impact their day-to-day functioning. Renee has a heart for high-quality assessments and writing comprehensive behaviour support plans that are neuroaffirming, respectful and provide a guide to changing the environment, not the individual. What a bio. Welcome to you, Renee.
Thank you.
So I met Renee sitting next to her at the AAPI psychologist convention, and we were in a neurodivergent workshop, and Renee came and sat next to me and we ended up chatting, and she works within positive behaviour support. And I had not had an opportunity to interview anybody on that topic, considering that 75% of people with ADHD also are autistic. There's a lot of people on this podcast that have autistic children that are on the NDIS. And we talk about the NDIS a lot. So I was pretty keen to grab Renee to come in and do the episode. It's also an area that I don't feel like I know enough about. I think there's a lot of misconceptions, myths around it. So bringing in someone like Renee, who's a passionate neuroaffirming practitioner, I thought could be really interesting for the mums on the podcast to hear, because I certainly had a lot of questions when I realised that she worked in positive behaviour support. Renee, do you want to tell me a little bit about yourself and why you work in the area? I know I've just read your bio, but if there's anything I've missed.
I guess one of the things that makes me really passionate about this area is it's changing the lens. So for a really long time, PBS, it's not actually well understood. There's also a lot of negative thoughts around PBS because it is rooted in applied behavioral analysis. It's rooted in that old school way of thinking. What I guess I try to do with PBS is it's actually changing that lens. It's allowing people to really look at what are actually the goods of this particular sort of method. And for me, I look at it PBS as it's a toolkit. And it's a toolkit of how do we understand what is going on for this individual? How do we understand what is driving things in their world that's causing them distress? And then understanding why they actually are exhibiting behaviors. Because if we can do that, then we can actually start to make a huge difference. And I think that's a really huge fundamental that people don't understand about PBS, especially coming into the NDIS now with relationship funding and that people have to have a behavior support plan. And for me, it is all about that should be a toolkit for families to say, this is who your individual is. These are the things that they're really struggling with. These are the things that we can change in their environment so that they're going to be able to function better. So it's not about changing the person. It's not about managing the behavior. It's not about focusing on what I call surface level behavior, which is all about managing, controlling, trying to change that behavior. For me, good PBS is about understanding what drives that, understanding what actually causes stress in this kiddo or adult's world, understanding why they're actually exhibiting these particular behaviours, because no behaviour happens for no reason. No one wakes up and goes, you know what, I feel like being really difficult today. I feel breaking a few windows, kicking a few doors, because that's fun. I like living like this. No one ever chooses to have a difficult day. And we forget this. We often come in and we look at surface level of behavior and think, oh, they've just got to stop doing that. And it's actually nothing to do with that. Behavior is often not a choice. It's a response. It's a response to what I call distress. It's a distress behavior. And for me, that's one of the fundamental differences in really good PBS should be looking at what actually drives, what's the underlying factors behind this behavior? Because when we can do that, when we can approach what's going on for a family with empathy, understanding, and empowerment, it makes a huge difference.
Wow. This is going to be great. I'm so excited. Okay. We're only like 5 minutes in. I'm so excited. Okay. There are some positives and negatives that the mums kind of chat about. And a lot of people have had both. They've had really positive, they've had really negative experiences. I suppose I shouldn't ask you what are the negative experiences. For example, we got approved for improved behaviour, which I was initially excited about. And I had a PBS practitioner call me who, this is just one. You've met one PBS practitioner, you've met one. And yeah, I felt a bit put off by some of the ways that she spoke to me about fixing, changing, give me problems, I'll fix them, I'll fix your kids. And of course, as a mum, I got my back up real quick that my children don't need to be fixed and that I haven't actually given anyone else a chance yet, which is why when I met you, I was really keen because I thought, what a great service if you could find the right person. And that's like anything, isn't it? That's like a therapist.
It is.
That's like a pediatrician. That's anything.
Correct.
What are the real positives that you have, you know, seen or experienced yourself within PBS?
I think I realise that I do PBS different to a lot of people, but I'm hoping that it becomes actually the norm. And for me, that comes back to the fact that I am neuroaffirming in the way that I approach things. I may not always get it perfect. And I always say that to my family, that if I make a mistake, you let me know, because I want to actually make sure that I make those corrections. And that, again, is not something everyone has the capacity to do. So I think that the fact I approach it differently helps. Some PBS practitioners are going to come with their own background, which means that they're either speech, OT, or they've come from an ABA background. They've come from that very, okay, behavior is to be fixed. And that in itself will change the experience everyone has with PBS. I can talk all day about some of the negative sides and the positive sides because it is such a gamut. But for me, what makes really good PBS stories, for me, it's things such as, for instance, I had a conversation with a dad who is the independent person for a young lady. And I was walking him through her behavior support plan and he actually stopped and he goes, I just wanted to say thank you. I think this is the first time I've ever read a comprehensive report on my daughter that made sense.
Wow.
He goes, you're spot on. He goes, you've nailed it. He goes, that actually makes sense. He goes, it's not just she breaks windows. It's not just, he goes, it's the why behind it, but then what we need to actually do to decrease that. And he goes, no one's ever given us that before. So sometimes it's this process of being able to really understand what you do. I think that's another really critical part, is that PBS is a growing space because of the NDIS, which means that we have some practitioners that will come in at core level. And that means that they don't yet have all the breadth of that information that they need to actually provide. Not to say that's a bad thing, because we all start from somewhere, but it means that they're going to make mistakes along the way. It means that they're going to, you know, need extra learning components. And I think that's where it's difficult, is that for parents, they often don't know what practitioner they're getting. They just simply get in their plan, you have a PBS component, you then get a PBS practitioner, but there's no dictating in that plan. You actually need a specialist level PBS. You need a core level, you need a proficient, you need an advanced PBS. And I think that's a really critical bit that's missing in NDIS plans, is that there are some individuals where a core practitioner will be fantastic. They can come in, they can be fun, they learn with you, especially if you have a team of speechies and OTs and other people that your core practitioner can learn alongside with. That can work for some families. There are others where we're dealing with really high level complex behaviors, and they're often let down if they get a core practitioner because they need someone who's coming in with more than just a PBS framework. And I think that that's what helps me, is coming from being a psychologist as well as a behavior support practitioner, I bring in both parts of my world, which allows me to do my job a little bit different. So positives come from, I guess, the way you connect with families. I think it's really important that PBS is not done in isolation. PBS is a collaborative process. As a PBS practitioner, we need to be spending time with our clients, with the individual. I will go in and I will sit on the floor and rock with my big guys. I will get messy. I come home covered in corn flour. I will need to have a spare change of clothes sometimes in the car, because what I thought was going to be a fun chalk bomb activity turned into me being covered in purple and pink and yellow spots. Don't wear black on days that you play with chalk bombs, Renee. But again, these aren't skills that everybody has. So you're looking for things like Do you have a practitioner that is going to be hands-on with your individual? Are they going to be just writing a report versus are they going to spend time really getting to know your individual? Because they're the things you're looking for. You're looking for people to want to be in the room with your kiddo or your adult, that they're not frightened, that they are able to work through really getting to know that. I will do observations in schools, in daycare, in workplaces, in the community, because often we need to see what's actually going on in a world. And sometimes in that viewing, we can go, oh, okay, no wonder they can't go into the shops. They don't like these sliding doors. There's a sensory component here. Let's actually look for some shops that don't have sliding doors. That's actually really hard, by the way.
I was just thinking that actually.
Sometimes when we can figure out what's actually causing distress, we actually can get really good results. And then it's translating that into what can actually help a family. Because part of, I guess, where things get really tricky is our world is really messy. It is unpredictable. It's not neat. It's chaotic at times. It is chaotic even for the best of us, let alone when you have sensory processing difficulties that make it really hard to go into Coles because Coles is just too bright, or the rattling of a trolley. So instead of doing social stories, I do social videos where I will go and video where they're going to go to. And I did a video for one of my kiddos about going to the shops. And so I videoed getting out of a car or walking over. And I listened back to my video and I was absolutely, it hit me in the face how loud that environment was. It was like the rattling of the trolley, the beeping, the going in. And it was like, I was listening back to it just going, if that's what he hears when he goes to the shops, I actually understand why that's so confronting. I don't know what setting I had my phone on, but it caught every single noise. And that reminded me that sometimes these are things that we need to actually reflect on, and we need to go, okay, it's not as straightforward as saying, oh, let's have this social story and let's take him to the shop. It was playing this video with him so that he could hear all those noises and that we could work on, okay, do we need to have our noise-canceling headphones? I guess that's also another thing, is that a PBS plan shouldn't just have a whole heap of tools in it that don't make sense for your individual, such as for some individuals, they don't need the noise cancelling headphones, but for others, it is a lifeline. For one of my boys, he needs a chew toy because he gets really anxious, but chewing actually helps him. Whereas another kiddo, if I suggested a chew toy, it's not going to be touched. And I think that we make a lot of errors in just over applying certain strategies when we really need to be looking at, well, what does this individual need? What's actually going to be helpful for this particular kiddo or an adult?
Oh, that's so interesting. And let's take a step back. Everyone on the podcast is used to me going forward and back. Let's take a step back. I think we throw around the word neuroaffirming a lot, but I would love to know, in your view, what the difference would be between a neuroaffirming PBS and a run-of-the-mill or a core or an ABA approach. Like, what would actually be the difference?
Okay, so for me, the difference is in two particular areas. It's the language we use to describe. That's a really big one. I am absolutely heartbroken sometimes when I read a behavior support plan that just, they're really disrespectful. It speaks about the individual in just not a great light. It's things like using the words attack, or they were targeting. And yes, these words might be true in some ways, but sometimes when you write a sentence such as he had a meltdown and will attack everyone and hits everyone and breaks windows, that does not tell me that this particular individual was probably extremely stressed, was extremely frightened, was felt very unsafe, and resorted to very high-level behaviors to express that they were distressed and they needed help and they wanted to feel safe and they wanted someone to help them. So I guess for me, that's a really big difference, is that you will find some reports are just, the language that's used makes a really big difference as to, are they neuroaffirming or is this just stock standard PBS? And that is something that I think we're still a long way to go. For me, that's a really big part of work that I do, is getting people to change their language. And this is probably more focused when we have support workers in place, the way, you know, they respond to behavior, because often they will say, he was naughty. He was not naughty, he was distressed. It's that little bit of a reframe, or they just want to control everything. No, they want predictability and routine. That's what we all like in our life. And that often when we are stressed and anxious, we want it even more because it helps us to feel calmer and helps us to predict. And if we can predict, we can actually ease our anxiety. So the way people write about is a really important one. The other for me is around relationships. And I think this is a huge missing component, is that often run-of-the-mill PBS will be all about, they have to have a reinforcer. You have to have incentives and rewards and sticker charts and stars and all these things. And that's a bit of a, we're moving away from that. Yes, rewards play a part in so many ways because we all like nice things when nice things happen, but it shouldn't be a contingency of do this, get this. Often what we miss is that it takes building a really good trusting relationship. And often when we can help an individual to have a really good guiding, trusting relationship, they can actually then guide self-regulation. And you can guide then co-regulation, and you can work together towards solving something. And that's a component I think that sometimes is missed in good PBS, is the importance on whoever is working with the individual. You really need to be there as hand in hand with them, that you're guiding without judgment. You're guiding without this thought process around punishment. It's changing your perspective of it's not naughty behavior, it's distressed behavior. And when we can make that switch, that for me is that difference with neuroaffirming, is that when we approach it from a neuroaffirming lens, we're looking at it as, aha, you're finding the environment really tricky. What can we do about that? How do we make this task more simple? So for me, giving examples for some of my kiddos, I'll give a really easy example. So I have a boy that is really sensory sensitive. And when I say sensory sensitive, to the point where smell. So he will often say to me, your breath smells nice. I'm a coffee drinker, so I always make sure that I've got gum. And he goes, the OT's breath does not smell nice. Compliments for me, but that type of a little comment, for me, when I'm working with this kid, I'm very mindful. I'm very mindful about that if he picks up an odor on you, you'll see him wince and you'll see him, like, he will struggle to actually stay engaged with you if you have a scent. So for me, that then translates into talking to people around being mindful of that. Yep, if you're a coffee drinker, you need to actually rinse your mouth out because he will find that really hard to engage with you. That can then be mistaken by people as misbehavior, that, oh, it's just being difficult, doesn't want to do his work, doesn't want to engage. And it's actually nothing to do with that. It's actually, he finds it really difficult when he's got to work in close proximity with people that smell. So smokers, I'm often saying to him, if you are a smoker, not that we should be smokers in this world of working with our individuals, however, he might find it really difficult. Or if you have really strong perfume or aftershave on, he might find it really difficult to sit and be in the same space with you. So something so simple can then change the way people perceive this kiddo, that rather than coming into it, thinking, oh, it's just being difficult, he doesn't want to do his work. Hang on, stop, do a self-check. How is my sensory presentation for him at the moment? Am I presenting the right way? I have another young girl. So where I work, it's a really old building. So it has that old sort of smell to it. And I literally watch her sometimes walking up my corridor and I can see her face. She's like squinting her nose and she's just on the smell. But I know that the second she walks into my office, for the 10 minutes before she arrives, and this is a scheduling thing, I actually open my window so that the old smell is hopefully mostly gone from the room. I also learned that cinnamon candles are not her thing and a few other different scents, but it's taken a few different candles to sort of work out a smell that makes her feel really comfortable. But again, why are these little stories important? Because this is what good PBS is. Good PBS is playing around with these little ideas, playing around with, does that make a difference for you? Because once I've got that, once I know what made a difference, then I can share that. And that means that at home, I talk to families about at home, we need to be mindful of smell. That if they've wet the bed and their bedroom has that smell of urine, that actually will probably, you know, cause a little bit of disruption that day because the sensory world is not meeting their needs. And that, can we open the window? Can we make sure that that's changed? Can we add scents that they like? And just those tiny changes make a huge difference, rather than that factor of, oh, they're being difficult, they're being naughty, they're misbehaving. thing. It's not about that. Often it is, they're telling us something's wrong in my world and please help me fix it because I can't figure it out. And sometimes these kids or individuals are not even self-aware at that stage that these things are tricky for them. And a good PBS practitioner will probe and, you know, be curious and be wanting to learn about that individual, because sometimes it's that aha moment that you go, oh, that actually makes sense.
It's almost like detective work. You're seeing the behavior. Mm-hmm. And yep. I would imagine that, especially kids, I don't even know why I'm grumpy sometimes, let alone a child.
Yeah.
So then, like, strapping back to, okay, when are they happy? What happened right before that? That kind of mood tracking, that's actually really interesting, especially if you can't just say, so why did you do that? And they go, because I don't like the person, yeah, the way that person smells. You're not going to get that answer that easily, I wouldn't imagine.
No, correct. No, because often they're not even aware at that stage that's what's happening. And these types of behaviors are really hard to unpack and figure out what's going on for a kiddo, because some of the individuals that I see, they don't yet use their voice, or they're relying on technology, that they're using augmented communication systems. So it might be even harder for them to tell me verbally what's going on. But what I can do is I can read, I can watch, and I can notice things like, okay, when we sit down and we try and do this, ah, oh, you actually don't like it when people sit this close to you. Is this better? And it's making these little adjustments and working out what works, working out what doesn't work. And a good PBS practitioner will take all of that information, and what then is produced isn't just a behavior support plan. It really is a guide. It's a guide to understanding. These are all the things that are really critical for you to know about this individual. And that includes really good understanding of diagnosis. How many individuals really understand autism, especially support workers? They hear the word autism, but they don't understand what that individual needs. They don't understand that when we say that they have a significant interest in elephants, that actually takes up a large chunk of their thinking for the day. So really helping individuals to understand the diagnosis, understand what is anxiety, understand what is PDA, understanding what demand avoidance looks like in our kiddos, that, hang on a minute, no, they're stressed and they're anxious. So that's a no deal. I said, that's their coping skill. This world feels really overwhelming right now. So you're getting a no deal because that's their protection. That's their mechanism for, I'm not coping very well. So helping to understand that is a key. So that's where I always come back to. For me, PBS is like a toolkit. It's a framework for helping families to understand what's actually going on. Understanding a good PBS plan will break down what is it, not just the generic stuff like this is autism or this is ADHD, but really taking that time to work out how does that impact this individual? What are the beautiful parts of it as well? What are their strengths? What are their abilities? I have a beautiful young man who is so able to make you feel like he will, if you have a name tag on, he'll read your name and he'll be like, oh, hi, Renee, which Chris will be like, oh, hi. It's a beautiful quality. It does also get him into a little bit of trouble when you're doing it to strangers that feel very uncomfortable having a young man that is putting their arm around them like their best friends. But understanding that he does that with this gorgeous intention, he's extremely social, he loves having conversations with people, actually helps us to reframe how people see his behavior. And that is a really important part of good PBS, is it reframing that narrative, reframing how other people have described behavior for a really long period of time, and providing something that is really respectful and something that helps families to go, that actually makes sense, versus just your child does this and you should do this, because that's not so helpful.
Oh, that's so interesting. I think an example is always good. So let's say I got a brand new car. I'd never had a brand new car before. I was very excited. And previously my car was a rubbish bin on wheels, and I just let them eat and drink because it was an old car and I just didn't care. So when I got the new car, I said to my three children, this is mummy's brand new car. I am so excited. I've never had a brand new car before. We're not going to be eating in mummy's car anymore. I know that the rules are going to be different, but it's a new car. I'm very excited, blah, blah. Anyway, and then one of them made a comment and said, what would you do if I spilt something on your car or you crashed your car? And I made a joke and said something like, I would erupt like a volcano, as a joke, and we all laughed. Okay, funny. I go inside, I come back, and my four-year-old has got a bucket of dirt, and he has opened the back door and he's thrown dirt into the brand new car, bucket of it. And I was upset, to say the least. I think I took it like a trooper compared to what most people would. I walked down the road and processed that by myself, came back, and we dealt with it. Obviously, I was pretty upset, and he helped me vacuum it out, and we did that together, and I wasn't very happy. Got up to see one of my psychologist friends the next day, and she said to me, "How are you going?" And I said, "I've got this brand new car. You wouldn't believe what happened." And she said to me, "Billy would be the most curious child I have ever met." And it was that reframe that actually helped me understand him better, because I was getting very frustrated with some of the things that were going on. Obviously, that's a frustrating thing to do. But when she reframed it in terms of curiousness and the fact that I had made a joke that I was going to erupt like a volcano, so he thought, "I wonder what that would look like." So he went to do something to upset me. So I noticed that when we talk to him, he will push the boundaries because he wants to see what will happen. He's driven by curiosity. He is a kid that will wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and watch a YouTube video of a snake coming out of a snake egg. He's curious. And I think it's so important what you're talking about to reframe it for parents as well as teachers. That's the reason I shared that, because that really changed the way that I viewed my child. Obviously, I loved him regardless, but it really helped me understand him. So I think that's so important.
Yeah. And for me, that reminds me of the second really important component of good PBS. And that is around, how do we de-escalate really big situations? And there's a huge component of this that for me, it's this factor of, we cannot calm someone down if we're not calm ourselves. So it's this factor of providing those tools of being able to lend our calm in those particular moments. And that is so hard when you've got a brand new car and you're thinking, "Oh my goodness, there's dirt." And that's a really important part as well, is being able to show people that often when our kids are in a stuck moment, when they have done something that we find really tricky to navigate, that our response really does matter. And that often in those moments, it is not about reprimands and punishment and yelling. It is about that coming back to that real attunement and being able to go, "I need a moment because I'm not emotionally regulated right this very second to respond to you." Taking that moment, regaining your ability to re-regulate, and then coming back in and being able to guide the situation versus adding more fuel to the fire. And that's a really important part of PBS, is being able to help families with that as well. I often get asked, what's the magic once they've started destroying the kitchen and things are flying? And there's no magic when it comes to that. It all comes into what we're doing as that escalation is building, and that in that top end, it is about safety, and it is about, how do I not add on to this so that this new situation continues to get worse? And that takes a lot of skill. And again, I don't know if all PBS practitioners necessarily are actually good at that component of it, because that in itself is a really tricky part of good PBS, is how do I give you skills to de-escalate? How do I give you skills to remain calm? And often we need to do things that are incongruent with how we want to respond. Our default often is how we were parented, which is, "Don't do that. Stop it." Again, if we're dealing with kids that are very stuck and very demand avoidance, those particular words, "No, stop, don't," are just going to trigger more behavior. So often it is about, how do I say no in a way that sets a limit and boundary, but without me needing to use those words? So I was going to give an example with one of my really complex young men that I work with. And often when he comes to see me at the clinic, he will come in and he often hasn't had lunch. And he often hasn't had lunch because the individuals that are supporting him may not have a really strong relationship with him. And on this particular day, it was about 2 p.m. and he still hadn't eaten. So my goal was to try and help him get some food, because I knew food would be a really important part of his regulation for that particular day. On that day, he had a sandwich that was soggy and probably not the best. And if I'm honest, I wouldn't have eaten it either. So I was trying to make do with the situation. So I've got some cheese in my fridge. We could maybe peel that off and scrape off the butter, and I could... He told me very clearly, "I don't want that." me trying to just guide. And this is a really nice example of best intentions. He was clearly telling me no, but I was trying to find a solution. And a lot of the work that we do will sometimes be about pushing a little and trying to find these ways to work with this. And on this particular day, he lost it. And he, I don't want the sandwich, yelling, races out of my clinic room and smashed my clinic door. Completely kicked it in. It was shattered, over $1,000 damage to this door. To which my response was really simply, I'd followed him down my hallway and said, "You're stuck." "Yes, I'm stuck. Thank you so much for telling me. I'm sorry that I wasn't listening. Let's see if we can find a solution together." So no more words. I didn't talk about the door. I didn't yell at him. I didn't ask why he did it. I knew why he did it. I didn't listen. And I needed to make that really clear with him that I'm sorry. I got that wrong. We walked down to my fridge. And I happened to have an up and go. I was like, an up and go instead. Yes, look at that. We solved it together. Fantastic. We walk back into my clinic and he sits there and he looks at me and he goes, "I'm so sorry. I just broke your door."
Oh,
that's okay.
Oh,
yeah, it's heartbreaking. I go, "That's okay. It's fixable." And he goes, "Okay." But for this kid, his usual response is adults yelling at him saying, "Why did you do that? Don't break things." And what it actually does is he just becomes more and more dysregulated. And this is the key to de-escalation, is that in the moment, it's already happened. I can't fix that door. It doesn't matter. Well, I can fix it. But in the moment, I can't. There's nothing else I can do. And we forget this. In the moment, we often yell because we are emotionally dysregulated. We're trying to regain control. And it's not about that. Good de-escalation is recognizing you need me to be really calm to you right now. You need me to respond with kindness. You need me to respond with compassion. And by doing that, what could have been a few hours of escalation was fixed in 2 minutes. And I had a kid that was apologizing within 2 minutes about the fact that he'd broken my door. And when he was leaving, he was referencing, looking at the door, looking at me, just to see, is she angry at me? Is she upset with me? Because that was his life experience. His life experience is, I have these moments where I damage things and people are always disappointed in me. And I'm always having these broken relationships with people because no one gets it. This kid's been coming into the clinic for 6 years. And that's the only flare up I've had with him. And sometimes it comes down to, it's this ability to show, how do we really de-escalate? And I love your example, Dane, because it is sometimes noticing things like, okay, they're really curious today. It's a very expensive bit of curiosity, but okay.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's a time consuming bit of curiosity today. But in being able to recognize and see behavior differently, rather than, now, if I had have looked at that door being broken as, oh, so naughty, you can't come back to the clinic, I'm angry about this, you end up with these big explosions and you end up with not really being able to help people. So a lot of what I do is guiding that. It's showing and talking with families about, okay, let's try a different response to that behavior. Let's not have these big responses that we've been having in the past. Let's change that story and let's re-narrate how we view that behavior. Huh, he's distressed. He's stuck. And that, I love using the word stuck with a lot of my teenagers. Like, oh, your brain is stuck. Yes, it's stuck. Because it's like this, oh, you've validated me. You've just helped me to recognize where I was, because often they don't know where they are. They don't know what they're stuck on. And then we give them these words to go, yeah, your brain is stuck. And once they've got that, it's like, yeah, I'm stuck. Then it's, we can move forward. So I think these are things that we don't talk enough about in good PBS, about what are the nuts and bolts? What are the things that we need to really be good at in guiding families?
Oh, I love that. And I think I don't need to tell you because this is how you obviously look at it. I'm just learning so much that if you look from that particular client, to have someone like yourself who can acknowledge and say, you're right, I wasn't listening. I tried to give you the sandwich again. You said no. That would be huge for him to have someone go, not say, oh, you shouldn't have done that door because you didn't want to eat the sandwich and that's not the right chain of behaviors. Well, actually, he's told you. I love that example, and I'm really reflecting on my own parenting where I'm like, they have something specific. One big game changer for me that I wanted to share with you was my daughter has a huge problem with socks and shoes. I don't know what severe would be. We've successfully bought 3 pairs of shoes in her life, successfully, like pairs that she's actually worn. So she's 8. So we've had 3 pairs that she's worn consistently ever. Obviously, we've bought 20,000 other pairs that she's not worn, but we've got 3 that fit that she will wear. Socks are a massive issue. And for years, when I didn't have an understanding of what she was going through, we would just try anything, begging, bribing, punishing, yelling. It was like 90 minutes to get a pair of shoes on one time. Painful. Like, I used to wake up in the morning and just think about the shoes coming to be dread. Anyway, when I sat down with her once and she was crying, and I honestly don't even think I took her to school that day. I was like, I'm just done. It's 9 o'clock, 9:30. I'm over it. And she said to me that when the shoes don't feel right, it hurts her. She goes, it feels like there's razors, there's nails. It hurts me. I feel like I can't cope. I feel sick. And when she described to me how she felt, oh, I approached it differently and I felt bad.
Yep. And this is something that we need to do so much more, regardless of disability or not, even for my own kids. It's remembering to check in sometimes with how do they feel about it? How do they see this situation? Because even though we might look like, oh, such a little problem, just put your socks on. It's not in their world. It's huge in their world. It is like, that is my number one problem today. And sometimes just that validating and being able to go, that's really tough for you. Let's try and find, and I love the Ross Green stuff around collaborative problem solving and just being able to meet a kid where they're at and being able to work out, okay, how do we solve this one today together? Rather than me giving you my parenting advice and telling you what I think you should do, it's how do we solve it together? And like with my kiddo and the sandwich, it was opening the fridge and having a look at, let's have a look, what's in here? And finding something that he had agreed, okay, I can do that. And it was solving it together. It wasn't me saying, you've got to have a sandwich, you need to eat, because if you eat, then you will feel better. Because that wasn't going to solve the problem. Even though we knew that was part of the solution, he needed to be part of that process with me as well. And we often forget this. Often, you're right, we do not check in enough with kids and adults with, okay, how is this difficult? Why is this difficult? I love being able to have conversations with some of my older individuals where they can tell me insightful things. I'll often, with, I guess, a little bit of the fact that I've been working in this area for so long, I've been really blessed with some of my 3-year-olds that I started with are now 28 and I still see them, and not as frequently, but they still come in and see me at the clinic. And I can have these really fun conversations where I'll be like, do you remember this when you were really little and you found that really tricky? And it's these beautiful conversations about, I was always scared. So one of my boys, it was a particular hallway at school. He would never walk down it. And as he got older, we were able to actually work on it, was the lighting. It was to do with the fact that he goes, I was scared. He goes, I couldn't see the doors properly. And I was like, okay. Yeah, it was the way it was shadowing. So he would just avoid this corridor hallway no matter what, because it didn't make sense to him when he was little. So checking in, I think, is a really important thing to come back to and to really be curious. A good PBS practitioner, that's probably the number one thing, is being curious, asking lots of questions, spending lots of time. I often laugh and say to my families, invite them for dinner. Because often, if they get to see what dinner time looks like, they have a much better idea about how they can help you. And I am that practitioner. Often my families will joke and go, it starts from 7 a.m. I'm like, okay, so I'm coming at 7 a.m. Cool. And I have driven out the family homes at 7 a.m. to be there from the second that they wake up to go, okay, show me what this looks like, so that I can get a better idea of, how do I actually help you? How do I figure out some solutions for these particular problems? How can I help you with this environment? Not all PBS practitioners are going to be able to do that. But if I'm thinking about things that families can be looking for, it's actually what you want to be asking. You want to be asking, how flexible are you with your work hours? Because often I have both a clinic as well as going out to family homes and schools and different environments. But often my families will say, oh, he comes into your clinic and he is best behavior. Like, you're not seeing even like a glimpse of what we get at home, and will agree to everything that you guys work gets home, won't do any of it. Okay, cool. I guess we're going to do some home session. Show me this. So
often a good PBS practitioner is someone that has that flexibility to go, okay, what environment do you need help in? And for me, I had a wonderful experience a couple of years ago. We had a new Kmart open in our local area, and it was actually helping one of my young ladies get a job. And Kmart were fantastic. We got to do a walk through Kmart before it was stocked. That's a really weird experience because we needed to check in things like the lighting. Is it going to be too bright? Would she be able to handle? Because sensory stuff for her was really tricky. But getting familiar with the store, we were able to do lots of visits. Sometimes PBS is not just in a clinic. It's not just over the phone. It's not just a file review. It's really getting to know a person. And I guess for families, that's what you're looking for. If I was to think about quick tips on how families can screen for, are you the right PBS practitioner for me? It's thinking about, why do you think you need PBS? And this is a really important question, because often our NDIS will go, oh, you've got behaviors of concern, so therefore you need PBS. True. However, often as a family, it's really figuring out, where is it that we need this help? Is it that we know what's going on for our kiddo, but our world is really, it's messy and it's chaotic, and we might need some help rethinking about some different strategies on how do we actually make some changes here that might be helpful for my kiddo? Is it, I really don't know why these particular behaviors are occurring, and I need someone that's going to be able to do that detective work, that they're going to be able to, can you go out and see my kid at school? Can you go out and do some observations in the park? Can you come over at dinner time? Because that's when we have lots of trickiness around food, or we have lots of trickiness with getting ready for school. So asking those questions about what's your practitioner's flexibility levels, because I know that there are some that do PBS only via telehealth. So if you're someone that thinks, I really need someone in my house, I need someone that can show me what this looks like, that can meet my kid, that can develop a relationship, they're really good questions to ask. The other is to ask their back. For families, knowing your PBS practitioner's background is also a really important component of selecting the right PBS. So for instance, if your kiddo is, you know, really struggling with sensory processing, or they have significant interoception sort of issues, you might be wanting to check in with, what is your PBS person's background? Because you might want someone that's also an OT, because they might then be able to give you an extra lens to the types of strategies that your kiddo is going to need. Or if you're really struggling to find their voice, to find a way to communicate, then you want a PBS that possibly has some sort of speech background, or at least has really good experience with using augmented communication systems. Because again, this is not something that PBS practitioners get training in. This is something that often PBS practitioners need to go off and either train themselves, or they come with that allied health background, which means they've got that knowledge system already built in to know what to do in that particular area. So these can be really helpful for a family if they're trying to work out, why do I need PBS? What is going to be the most helpful for me? Then that can also help to determine the type of PBS practitioner that you are looking for.
Oh, I'm a bit mind blown. Okay, I've written down a lot of things. This has been amazing. But for me personally, I don't know anyone on the podcast. I'm loving this. Okay. What do you want to ask was, what would be a few of the things that parents could do at home that would be able to support positive behavior? What are some things that we could do that generally always work, considering all children are different?
I guess the number one, if I'm really thinking about what are the things that drive lots of distress for kiddos, it's really routines and consistency is probably a really big one. And often when we're honest with ourselves about our schedules, about our timetabling, we can sometimes go, oh my goodness, it's like a cereal box that I've just shook up. And often sometimes that is going to be a really easy start point for families. Sometimes it's about sitting down and being really raw and honest with yourself about, is it working? And this includes, am I on the therapy bandwagon? Am I doing too much stuff? Because I've got some kiddos that love me and they will see me and go, oh no, not Renee today. And I'm like, oh dude, I'm so sorry. And it's not me. It's the fact that I'm the fourth appointment that week for them. And often kids will burn out themselves and just go, oh, not another person. So sometimes a really easy start point is sitting down and working out, what do we need? How much of it do we need? And is it working? I have this discussion with lots of families that, you know, when they are first diagnosed, that they're doing OT and they're doing social skills groups and they're doing their speech and they're going to physio and they feel exhausted. And I'm like, if you're exhausted, your little one is even more exhausted. And it's this dilemma between one aspect, people are told, oh, early intervention, you've got to do it all, you've got to do more. And I think sometimes that actually drives more behavior. And sometimes that is the start point, is to go, okay, what do we need? What do we need to cut back on? And for some families, it might actually be, okay, we have three other kids in the house. I actually need help. I can't do this with just the standard parenting structure as well as meeting my child's needs. And sometimes that might be, okay, am I open to someone coming in and giving us a hand in the afternoons to get more things done so that I can focus with my kiddo, that I can have more time with them? So that's one point. Sometimes then around routine and consistency, visual schedules can be hit and miss. And again, this comes back to, I like to know what I'm doing in my day. If I don't have my trusty diary and an alarm and a few other things set up, I will completely miss things because I don't hold all that information in my mind. And we forget this with kids and with individuals with a disability, that they are no different to us. They like to know what's going on. And often I had a kid that would go, Daddy's home constantly. And here the solution was, I just went and wrote on a whiteboard what time Dad was getting home. And the question stopped. And I was like, oh, it was that simple. Because what he was doing was he wasn't holding onto the piece of information. So he just continuously checked in all day because he loves Dad and Dad was fun. And when Dad got home, that meant good times. So that's all he was focused on. So simply knowing what time Dad was coming home was a really simple way to give him a way to reduce his anxiety. And we forget about this, is that if we imagined having a day where we didn't know what appointments we've got to go to, we don't know where we're supposed to go, our anxiety is going to be up here. It might be a matter of being able to just have something somewhere in your house that just shows, these are the plans for today. We've got school, then we're going to go to grandma's house, and then we're having roast pork. Like, it might be something really simple. Don't get stuck on following them rigidly, because that also, I think, can, you know, be really difficult, and especially if you're working with a demand avoidant kid, they're just going to go, don't tell me what to do. But if it's just there in the background, even if they're just walking past it, it's still a system to say, hey, this is roughly the plans for today. We've got grandma's house tonight. So it's not a surprise. It's not a suddenly I'm going to grandma's house. It's something that we can prepare for. And that's a really easy system that we sometimes, as adults, we get busy and we forget how important it is for our little ones to know as well what's going on in their world. So that's one sort of factor. Depending on what it is that you're working on. But for some of my kiddos, it's clutter. Some of my kiddos, it's too many toys out and my brain is overloaded. I know that for myself, if I walk into my office and I've got too much clutter and things are out of order, I feel messy in my mind. So order and symmetry sometimes for individuals can be really important, that they need it to be where it's supposed to be. For others, that doesn't matter. So sometimes it's the simple stuff. Sometimes it's working out, what is it that my kiddo really needs at the moment? I guess things that parents can do at home comes down to, don't try and do it all. Behavior change is not an overnight process. It's like a marathon. It starts with building that relationship first, because often we forget that component. It's getting down on the ground with your kiddo and doing their things with them in a way that then allows you to guide that change. It's not do this, it's let me show you. If I'm trying to help a kiddo to learn how to regulate time better, then I'm going to do lots of fun stuff around, okay, we're going to blow bubbles for 10 seconds and then we're going to stop and then we have to blow it again for 5 seconds, stop. And I'll play with time in a fun and guiding way that is not, okay, stop, go, but showing them, wow, look at that. We were stopping and going today and we were good, because often it's about guiding. So there, I guess there's those little things. It's knowing what is important to the individual is really important. And I think that we get a bit stuck in as adults. So food is probably a really nice example. We get stuck on, they need to eat a bigger variety of food. They need to eat different meals.
And I have a couple of kiddos that I've actually stopped that thinking, because they're actually eating a nutritionist meal. They've got all of the right vegetables. It's the same meal because that's what they like. They don't like it to be different. They like their vegetables to be sitting in the top left-hand corner, and they like the meat to be sitting down in the right corner, and the sauce needs to be in a little container. It shouldn't be touching any of those things. And we get a little bit stuck as neurotypicals about, oh, it needs to be variety and, you know, it needs to be different. And that's actually wrong. So sometimes it can also just be being able to accept, okay, this is how my kiddo likes their food. And so long as we're meeting their nutritional goals, I actually need to let some of that stuff go. And I need to be okay with that. And that can also be a really important part for families in being able to really navigate what's really important right here for me right now, rather than trying to fix it all and change everything. Because if you do that, life gets tricky and then it feels yuck for everybody. And this is also where PBS can also fall down, is that if you go in too strong, trying to change everything, everything feels yuck, nothing works, behaviors get worse. And then we default to, no, it's not working, I'm going to stop.
Yeah.
Versus taking small, manageable steps and taking the steps that make sense for your family is the most important little steps, rather than trying to fix it all, because it's taking these small, tiny steps on a daily basis. It moves you towards the bigger goal. And then being able to reflect on, is this working for me? Because that's the other thing, is that I often say to families, do not be afraid to say to you, Renee, that strategy sucked and it did not work. And we don't like that strategy in our house, because sometimes I will get it wrong. And it is a collaborative process. It's being able to say, okay, that is too time consuming for me. I can't do that every time. I had this conversation with a mum just the other day. We're talking about toilet training, and she's like, oh, this whole thing of take the nappy off him and I've got to sit outside and watch it. She goes, I don't have time for that. And every strategy that people are coming to give her is all time consuming. And we've got a mum that is, she's juggling life. She is trying to work, trying to toilet train her kiddo. So it then comes back to, okay, let's actually find some different ways that work for you, rather than trying to give you these methods that you're not going to be able to do, because you don't have that freedom of, and who does? Who has 2 weeks to just sit at home? And yeah, so it comes back to families also being able to say, actually, that strategy doesn't work for us. Can you please come up with something else? And don't be afraid to ask that of your practitioner. That's what we're there for. Our role is to sometimes be wrong and to sometimes be able to listen to you and go, hey, that's a much better idea. Let's change that, rather than being very stuck and rigid.
And if there was a magic solution, a one size fits all, that would be easy, wouldn't it? But if you're doing detective work, basically, you're probably going to be wrong a percentage of the time.
Absolutely.
I love what you're saying. One thing that I did want to ask you as well was, you touched on the therapy fatigue, which I completely relate to. And I think I feel for a lot of the parents that listen to this podcast, because it's that perfect storm. They have a child that hits prep. There's red flags. They go to the pediatrician. It's genetic. Now it's them. It's their husband. Everyone's diagnosed all in one big kind of 6 month period. Early intervention starts. It's messy, intense. Everyone's processing. And also some of the providers I have found have been a bit salesy. They've got all of the different therapists and they put you on this weekly schedule that initially I thought the NDIS had put me on. And then I realized that actually that was his business that had put me on the schedule and I could say no. So it can be confusing initially as a parent. I was wondering if you do only have one or two things that you can do a week or you have time to do, what would be something that, or the thing that you would prioritize if you had to pick?
Again, loaded question.
Sorry, they're big ones, aren't they?
Oh, no, it's a big one. That answer is going to be different for every family. So it depends on, I guess the thing to start on for a family is, what is the one thing that would make a huge difference in our life right now if we could change that? And for some families, it might be communication system. It might be, I need to learn how to communicate with my little one because we are, you know, constantly in meltdown mode because I can't meet their needs because I can't figure it out. So if that's the primary focus, then I would say, let's focus on, how do we actually help with that? How do we incorporate communication into every aspect? Another technique that I often give to families is, it's not about doing therapy. It's about bringing the therapy into what you do rather than you trying to carve out time for therapy or taking them to a therapist or taking them to do sessions. So if you think about when we're teaching, like using speech as an example, when my kids were learning to talk, I didn't carve out, I'm going to do an hour of speech therapy with them. I'm going to really work on that B. It's the fun. It's if you're on a slide, it's up and go. You are constantly finding these little opportunities in everyday things to help develop your child's language. You're not carving out time specifically. I'm just going to focus on getting them to talk today. And I think that we lose this when it comes to when we have a child that is a little, you know, different in their approach to how they're learning to talk. And we then become really focused on, and again, that whole early intervention factor. You've got to do 20 hours of therapy and you've got to, it's not. It's actually about how do I become more mindful about what I'm already doing and use those opportunities. So I will often, if I've got a mum with a newly diagnosed, like, okay, so when you're putting the load of washing on, let's work on using that as an opportunity for regulation. So get them to pass you the socks. So you can create a regulatory pattern of working together rather than trying to find ways to do therapy separately, bring it in to what you're doing. And I think that's a really easy way for families to work on with their kids. If it's things like, okay, I need to not say no so often and I need to think about different things, I might say, okay, for the day, I want you to focus on don't say no, say when, which means that every time you have this urge to go no, you're going to go, that's a great idea. We can do that tomorrow. I'm going to go put that on the fridge. Oh, I know you love chocolate. I love chocolate. We both eat too much chocolate. Let's put chocolate on tomorrow's dessert list. So it's this learning, how do I avoid, because often we default to, no, you can't have chocolate. No, you can't go to the park. No, it's not time for this. No, it's time for bed. No, no more stories. It's time for sleeping. But rather than just staying in that stuck point of you saying no, I might give a sort of an idea to say to parents, okay, a simple way is thinking today, how do I use more declarative language? How do I change the way I'm communicating with you so that I'm not being so imperative and I'm not, you know, giving you lots of demands and instructions that are going to create sparks in our house? And it's a really simple task. It might be things like, rather than saying, we have to go, shoes on, jackets on, get out the door. It might be things like, oh, your feet look really cold. I wonder what else we need. And yes, it's this really nice technique that just allows families to move from this crisis and this stress and this boiling pot to, okay, I can guide without having to use these language bases that spark and end up thing. So there's lots of ways families can implement PBS at a really simple level. And it can be things like changing the way we're communicating. It can be taking one component, like what's one goal in your PBS plan that you think, okay, that's really important to me. Then sit down with that goal and think about, how can I bring that goal into our world? How do I work on that myself? How do I bring this into when I take him shopping? If we've got a kiddo that really struggles with behavior inhibition, it could be things like get them to push the trolley and just work on, and you might have a trolley side by side and we'll work on modeling, stopping and going and giving that focus of, okay, we have to pause. Oh, we need to choose some rice. Which rice shall we get today? And giving them that process of grabbing the rice and putting it in, rather than stop, no, wait for me, don't run off. It's thinking about, how do I bring some, you know, really simple strategies into what we're doing? And these are things that should be a conversation with your PBS practitioner about, great plan, good goals. How do I make these functional? How do I bring this into what we're doing so that it's easy rather than feeling like now I've got more things that I need to do? And that's the same with that therapy component of feeling like I've got to get to speech therapy and OT and physio and equine therapy and swimming lessons. And sometimes there's a time in life for everything. And I think for me, that's a really important point for families, is that work out what it is that's really important to you right now and just focus on that, especially if you're running on an empty cup. If you are already finding yourself in this really, I'm overloaded, I'm dealing with my child's diagnosis, I'm dealing with feeling that I'm not meeting their needs, I'm already stressed, and then all of these extra therapies bring you additional stress, sometimes it's okay to say, okay,
for the next 6 months, let's just focus on this area. And we're going to come back to this when that becomes important. So for instance, if your kiddo is little and school is, you know, still a few years away, focus on the stuff that makes a difference for you now and come back to that later. You don't need to do it all at once.
Wow, such great advice, Renee. God, you're a legend. I've learned so much. There's so much to PBS that I didn't know. So this has been mind-blowing, and I've got all the PBS funding there, but I haven't utilized it. So I'm really going to move forward with that because I think there's so much more that I could do. And maybe I was put off, hey, you get something stuck in your mind. That's not for me. But having spoken to you, pity you live in, this has been really amazing. And I love the way that you speak with such respect and love for the children and the people that you work with, because that's really special and not everybody in every industry truly loves it. I can see that you do.
That is very true. That's one thing I always say is that you can't teach people how to be compassionate and love this field and love making a difference. For me, it's simply that. It's making a difference. I think one of my best gifts still to this day is a Christmas card that one of my families gave me a number of years ago, and their boy is now 26, I think. And I think he would have been maybe in high school. And it just simply said, thank you for giving us back our son. And that still sits with me because that is what I do. And I think that good PBS practitioners, that is sometimes what you're looking for. You're looking for people that work with their heart and their head, but it is about making a difference. And sometimes progress might be really slow for some families, but it's still making a difference. And it doesn't matter how slow you go. We are often stuck in thinking that we're in such a rush in this world, and we're actually not. Sometimes slow and steady actually is the only way to move forward, because in doing so, we actually make the biggest difference. So I guess if you do have a PBS component of your NDIS plan, it is sitting down and thinking about, how could a PBS practitioner come on board and help me with particular areas? How could they help my kiddo? How could they help our family in changing the way we communicate, changing the way that we structure our day, thinking about, okay, our routine is actually a bit tricky. And sometimes that's a sounding board. Sometimes having someone else sit down and think about, have you thought about this, can be like those, oh yeah, actually I haven't thought about that. That's a great idea. So PBS can be used in lots of different ways. The fundamentals of PBS is our goal is to actually improve quality of life. And that can be working directly with the individual. Sometimes it's training teams. I will often do disability support worker training sessions where it's really helping the team wrapped around this kid or adult to really understand what's going on, why these behaviors occur, how they can make a difference. Or it might be around, how do I help people learn to de-escalate? So I think if you've got PBS in your NDIS plan, it's sitting down and thinking about, how do I utilize this funding so that it helps us to make a difference? Then it's finding the right practitioner, because once you know what you want to use your funding for, then you know what questions to ask of your practitioner, and you'll also have a much better gauge on who do I think is going to be a good fit with our family. And like with everyone, we're going to get along with everyone in the world. It's okay for you to sometimes meet a professional and go, that didn't gel. You're not stuck. Sometimes it is about finding the right fit and finding someone that hopefully can work from that neuro-affirming lens, that they do come from a background where they do genuinely want to make a difference and they have an appetite for working in this area of wanting to be genuine and real and not sitting on a pedestal up here, but being able to go, okay, show me what this looks like. Show me how I can help you, and working together with families.
I love that. Look, thank you so much, Renee. I'll put all of her notes in the episode notes. So I'll put all of Renee's information. So if you want to get in contact with her, you can. And I just want to thank you, Renee, for such quality information in a short period. I feel like I learned so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity. And I really do hope that it's been helpful.
Definitely. The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.